4. How 80-20 running improves fitness. We have now seen compelling evidence that the 80-20 method of training increases fitness more effectively than other methods do. But how does it actually work? The 80-20 rules pioneer, Stephen Saylor, is careful not to claim that this question has yet been fully answered. While we can say with a high degree of confidence that 80-20 training works, he told me, we still cannot precisely explain why it works. So this is still an area for research to be done. Saylor and his colleagues have proposed a few possible explanations for the superiority of 80-20 training that they plan to test in future studies. One possibility is that low-intensity training is more beneficial than it has been given credit for, especially when done in large amounts. Another theory is that runners actually get more benefit from high-intensity training when they do most of their training at low intensity. A third hypothesis is that both moderate and high-intensity training are too stressful to be done in large amounts. These explanations are not mutually contradictory, and it may turn out that they are all correct. Indeed, existing evidence strongly indicates that 80-20 training is more effective than other methods for all three reasons. Aerobic capacity and performance. The physiological cornerstone of running performance is aerobic capacity, or the body's ability to extract oxygen from the environment and use it to release energy from muscle fuels. The human aerobic system includes the heart and lungs, the arteries and capillaries that deliver blood to the muscles, the blood itself, and mitochondria, which are little factories within muscle cells where oxygen is used to release energy from metabolic fuels. Running induces changes in all these organs that serve to increase aerobic capacity. The key requirement for strengthening the aerobic system is stress. Unless you subject your aerobic system to a significantly greater challenge than it faces when you are at rest, it will not adapt. Specifically, you need to elevate your heart rate to at least 60% of maximum. So, if your maximum heart rate is 185 beats per minute, BPM, you must run fast enough to get your heart rate up to roughly 111 BPM to boost your aerobic fitness. While 60% of maximum heart rate is the minimum threshold for aerobic benefit, increasing the intensity beyond that threshold brings additional benefits. Research has repeatedly demonstrated that high-intensity exercise strengthens the aerobic system faster than does low-intensity exercise. In one recent study, scientists at McMaster University looked at the effects of exercise intensity on mitochondrial protein synthesis inside muscle cells. These proteins are used to create fresh mitochondria so the muscles can use oxygen more rapidly to fuel their work. The faster these proteins are synthesized, the more densely packed with mitochondria the muscle cells become. The McMaster University researchers discovered that a single high-intensity workout increased mitochondrial protein synthesis significantly more than a low-intensity workout over a period of 24 hours. The same pattern holds when scientists look at other parts of the aerobic system, such as the heart. Research has shown that high-intensity exercise increases the contraction force or power of the heart muscle more effectively than does low-intensity exercise. However, there are some things that low-intensity exercise does better. For example, a number of studies have shown that during prolonged running at low intensity, the muscles release large amounts of a cell signaling compound called interleukin-6, IL-6, which contributes to fatigue. Well-trained runners produce less IL-6, and this is one reason they are more fatigue-resistant. It is believed that exposure to large amounts of IL-6 during running is itself the primary trigger of physiological adaptations that reduce IL-6 release in future workouts and boost endurance. In turn, the primary trigger for IL-6 release is depletion of glycogen fuel in the working muscles. Long, slow runs cause much higher levels of glycogen depletion, and hence also of IL-6 release, than do short, fast runs. A hard run lasting 16 minutes may increase IL-6 levels twofold. A one-hour run will increase them tenfold, and a full marathon a hundredfold. So the effects of low-intensity and high-intensity exercise on the aerobic system are somewhat complementary. Maximizing aerobic capacity, therefore, requires that a runner do some of both. The question then is not whether one is better than the other, and thus ought to be done exclusively. The question, rather, is how high-intensity and low-intensity training should be balanced. Physiological evidence suggests that the amount of low-intensity training a runner does both can and should be high. It can be high because low-intensity running is not extremely stressful, so a runner really has to go overboard with slow running to reach the point of overtraining. The amount of low-intensity training a runner does also should be high because the benefits of low-intensity running continue to accumulate for a long time as the volume of such training increases. Some runners are skeptical that slow running can possibly continue to be beneficial once they've already gotten in pretty good shape. After all, as I've stated, strengthening the aerobic system requires some stress be applied to it, and slow running isn't very stressful for experienced runners. But the stressfulness of running is not strictly determined by intensity. Rather, it is determined by the volume of intensity. Sure, a 30-minute run at low intensity applies little stress to a fit individual, and thus may provide no benefit in isolation. But a 2-hour run at low intensity probably will challenge the aerobic system of any runner, especially if the runner in question ran an hour or so the day before. Research shows that low-intensity training is truly a gift that keeps on giving. The more slow running you do, up to a point, of course, the more you get in return. Let's return to our example of interleukin 6. As I mentioned before, the farther a person runs, the more fitness-boosting IL-6 his muscles release. While the fitter a person becomes, the less IL-6 the muscles release in a run of any given distance. A beginner may produce enough IL-6 in a slow 30-minute run to stimulate positive adaptations, whereas an experienced runner may not. To stimulate further adaptations, this second runner will need to run farther, but she need not run faster. In fact, running faster won't help in this instance because, as we heard before, IL-6 release is affected by the duration of running more than the speed. Alternatively, the experienced runner can run slow more often and get the same effect. Runners release more IL-6 when they start out with semi-depleted glycogen stores, and runners who train frequently are often unable to fully replenish these stores between runs. High-intensity running is different. While a small amount of high-intensity running is more beneficial to the aerobic system than is a small amount of low-intensity running, large amounts of faster running offer no additional benefit. In fact, large amounts of high-intensity training are so stressful to the body that they suppress the parasympathetic nervous system, resulting in chronic fatigue and loss of performance. So the sum of what we know about the physiological effects of low-intensity and high-intensity exercise tell us that the optimal combination is one that is weighted heavily toward low-intensity. Studies of the actual effects of different combinations of slow and fast running on aerobic capacity, or VO2 max, confirm this expectation. One such study was conducted by Véronique Bellat in 1999. Her subjects were 8 competitive middle-distance runners who ran 6 times per week. For the first several weeks of the study period, these runners did all of their runs at low intensity. Then, they shifted to a schedule of 5 low-intensity runs and 1 high-intensity run per week, or a balance of 83% low-intensity workouts and 17% high-intensity workouts for a period of 4 weeks. Finally, the runners transitioned to a schedule of 3 easy runs and 3 high-intensity runs per week, or a balance of 50% low-intensity workouts and 50% high-intensity workouts for 4 weeks. At the end of each phase of the study, the initial 100-0 phase, the subsequent 83-17 phase, and the final 50-50 phase, the runners completed a VO2 max test to measure changes in aerobic capacity. The average VO2 max at the end of the first phase was 71.2, which is quite high. 4 weeks later, at the end of the 83-17 phase, the group's VO2 max had risen to 72.7, an increase of 1.5%. 4 weeks after that, at the end of the 50-50 phase, the average VO2 max was 70.9, a decrease of 2.5% from the previous level. In summary, doing 3 high-intensity workouts per week was not only less beneficial than doing just one, it was worse than doing none at all. Additional data collected by Bellat and her colleagues explained why. During the 50-50 phase of the study, the runners exhibited very high levels of norepinephrine, a stress hormone, immediately after hard running. This finding, combined with a second observation of lower heart rates during intense running, indicated that the parasympathetic nervous system of these runners was suppressed. They were overtrained. Other studies support Blatt's finding that the aerobic system is strengthened most effectively by a combination of lots of low-intensity running and a little high-intensity running. In the previous chapter, I discussed the Salzburg study, which compared the effects of four different blends of low-intensity, moderate-intensity, and high-intensity training on performance in an incremental exercise test. We determined that a polarized training program featuring 68% low-intensity training produced the best results. The authors of the study, Thomas Stogel and Billy Sperlick, also measured the effects of the four training protocols on aerobic capacity. The winner again was the polarized program, which increased VO2 max by a stunning 11.7% in 9 weeks. The high-intensity program, which featured 43% low-intensity training and 57% high-intensity training, increased VO2 max by only 4.8%. It bears mentioning that the training plans given to both of these groups were in fact polarized. In other words, both groups were required to avoid the moderate intensity range. The only difference in their training was the balance of work done at low and high intensities. In relation to the polarized group, therefore, athletes in the high-intensity group were actually hurt by doing 57% of their training at high intensity versus 24%. Beyond that point, each minute they spent at high intensity instead of low intensity worsened their results. It is also important to recognize that the two groups in the Salzburg study that did the most moderate intensity training, the high-volume group and the threshold group, fared worst of all. Subjects in the threshold group, for example, did 54% of their training at moderate intensity, which again is close to what most recreationally competitive runners do, and they experienced a 4.1% decline in VO2 max. Steven Saylor sometimes refers to moderate intensity training as the black hole of training intensities because it is almost as stressful as high intensity training while being far less stimulative of aerobic development. So runners must be at least as wary of sabotaging their training with excessive moderate intensity running as they are of overcooking themselves with too much speed work.
Aerobic capacity and fatigue resistance. A high aerobic capacity is not intrinsically beneficial. No prizes are awarded for VO2 max numbers. The reason runners covet a high aerobic capacity is that it contributes to running performance in a couple of ways. Before we get to that, let me first explain what a higher aerobic capacity will not do for you, and that is make you faster in any pure sense. In fact, maximizing your aerobic capacity through optimal training will actually make you a slower sprinter over short distances. It is a little known but well-proven fact that developing the aerobic system reduces top-end speed. Some of the training-induced changes in muscle function that boost performance in, say, a 5K race actually impair performance in something like a 40-yard dash. For example, training to increase aerobic capacity reduces the cross-sectional size of certain muscle fibers. This adaptation leads to economical running over long distances, but it also lessens the maximum power output of the muscles. And as maximum power output goes down, so does top-end speed. Exercise scientists sometimes use a vertical jump test to measure the maximum power output of the leg muscles. This test is a good predictor of sprint performance because sprinting is really a form of lateral maximum power jumping. One study found that vertical jump performance declined by close to 2% in college cross-country runners over the course of a season. It is probable that these runners lost an equivalent amount of top-end speed. What's more, training for increased aerobic capacity also reduces anaerobic capacity, or the ability of the muscles to burn fuel quickly without oxygen and support of intense efforts one notch below a full sprint. Exercise scientists typically measure anaerobic capacity with a Wingate test, where subjects are required to pedal as hard as they can for 30 seconds on a stationary bike. Power output invariably declines after the first 5 or 10 seconds, which is what distinguishes this test from a test of all-out speed. The average healthy college student performs better in the Wingate test than does the typical college cross-country runner. And the typical college cross-country runner himself would perform better in a Wingate test after a 2-month break from training. In his famous Sports Illustrated article from 1962, Arthur Lydiard argued that distance runners do not need to increase their maximum speed. He was right about that. But it turns out that runners can't increase their maximum speed if they train for increased aerobic capacity. Sacrificing VO2 max for raw speed would be a giant mistake for any distance runner, because boosting aerobic capacity through optimal training offers two benefits that matter much more to this type of athlete. One, it increases the speed that runners can sustain over long distances. And two, it increases how far runners can go at submaximal speeds. It is no accident that in the Salzburg study, the training program that induced the largest increase in aerobic capacity, polarized, also yielded the greatest improvements in time to exhaustion and in the highest speed attained in an incremental exercise test. Aerobic metabolism is more efficient and less fatiguing than other ways the muscles have of powering themselves. The more oxygen your muscles are able to use to fuel your running, therefore, the faster you can run over long distances and the farther you can run at race speeds. Interestingly, increases in aerobic capacity are associated with much larger gains in fatigue resistance, the sustainability of speed, than in speed over distance. I'll show you how with an example. The average VO2 max of a young adult female is about 38 milliliters per kilogram per minute. For males, it's about 42 milliliters per kilogram per minute. According to the exercise physiologist Jack Daniels, a runner with average running economy, a topic I'll address in the next chapter, and a VO2 max of 49 milliliters per kilogram per minute is likely to be able to run 5K in 20 minutes 18 seconds, or 6 minutes 32 seconds per mile. Now, let's suppose that, through a smart 80-20 training, this runner eventually increases her VO2 max to 56. According to Daniels, it's likely that this runner will now be able to run 5K in 18 minutes 5 seconds, or 5 minutes 49 seconds per mile. That's an improvement of 10.9% in speed over the 5K distance. But this same runner, by lifting her VO2 max from 49 to 56, will now be able to run a marathon in 2 hours, 53 minutes, 20 seconds, or 6 minutes, 36 seconds per mile, which is very close to her original 5K pace. A marathon is 8.5 times longer than a 5K. So the same increase in aerobic capacity that improves speed over distance by 10.9% elevates the sustainability of speed by 850%. The giant disparity in the scale of the two main benefits of increased aerobic capacity gives us reason to suspect that improved fatigue resistance in runners is not entirely accounted for by gains in VO2 max. This suspicion is supported by studies in which runners lose fitness instead of getting fitter. For example, in a study conducted by Danish researchers in 1985, well-trained endurance athletes were asked to reduce their training volume from between 6 and 10 hours per week down to just 35 minutes per week for 4 weeks. At the end of that 4-week period, their VO2 max was unchanged, but their time to exhaustion at 75% of VO2 max had dropped by 21%. The athletes had lost a ton of fitness, specifically fatigue resistance, but you wouldn't have guessed it from looking at their aerobic capacity. Gains in aerobic capacity do in fact account for the bulk of the improvement in performance that newer runners experience. It doesn't take long, though, to raise VO2 max as high as it will ever go. Yet runners often continue to lower their race times for many years after their aerobic capacity has plateaued. At the elite level, runners who take up the sport in high school typically attain their lifetime peak VO2 max by their second year of college. Their best race times, however, often don't come until a full decade later. Consider the example of Paula Radcliffe, one of the greatest female runners of all time.
Andrew Jones of Manchester Metropolitan University tracked changes in Radcliffe's physiology and performance from 1991, when Radcliffe was 17 years old, until 2003, when she was the best female distance runner in the world. Her highest VO2 max was recorded at the very beginning of this period. At that time, Radcliffe was running 25 to 30 miles per week, and her best time for 3,000 meters was 9 minutes 23 seconds. 5 years later, she was running more than 100 miles per week, and her best 3,000-meter time was 8 minutes 37 seconds. Yet her VO2 max was no higher. In fact, it was slightly lower. What had changed was Radcliffe's ability to sustain the speed she'd always had over longer distances. By 2003, she was running as much as 160 miles per week on an 8-day cycle that included 15 runs, 12 of which, or 80%, were done at low intensity. Her VO2 max was still unchanged, but in that year, she set a still-standing marathon world record of 2 hours 15 minutes 25 seconds and ran a half marathon at an average pace of 5 minutes per mile, or 2 seconds per mile faster than the pace she had run for 3,000 meters, less than 2 miles, when her VO2 max was at its peak. While Paula Radcliffe was an exceptional runner in terms of performance, she was not exceptional in terms of how she improved. Runners of all ability levels routinely become more fatigue resistant and thereby lower their race times without increasing their aerobic capacity. Indeed, in the Salzburg study, members of the threshold group increased their time to exhaustion in the incremental exercise test by 8% despite the 4.1% decline in VO2 max they experienced. Such research evidence supports real-world evidence from the likes of Paula Radcliffe that the long-term improvements in fatigue resistance runners get from proper training come largely from a source other than increased aerobic capacity. Scientists have recently learned that this other source of fatigue resistance is centered in the brain, and like aerobic capacity, it is enhanced most effectively by low-intensity, high-volume training. Let's now see how it works. The psychology of fatigue resistance. From the time it was first identified by Archibald Hill in the 1920s, aerobic capacity was erroneously considered the be-all and end-all of endurance performance. The reason for the mistake had to do with how aerobic capacity was measured. The traditional VO2 max test ties together oxygen consumption and fatigue in an artificial way that gives the appearance that aerobic capacity is the one and only factor limiting endurance performance. Modified versions of the test that do away with this problem reveal that a brain-based tolerance for suffering plays as big a role as aerobic capacity does in relation to fatigue resistance. The traditional method of measuring a runner's VO2 max is known as a graded exercise test. In this test, the subject runs on a treadmill while breathing into a mask connected to a machine that collects exhaled gases and uses them to calculate oxygen consumption. The speed of the treadmill is increased by a fixed amount every 2 minutes until the subject quits in exhaustion. Sometimes, a subject's oxygen consumption increases in lockstep with his or her running speed right up to the point of quitting. Other times, oxygen consumption plateaus a step or two before the runner quits. In either case, the design of the test ensures that the highest recorded rate of oxygen consumption falls close to the point of quitting, making it seem as though nothing else besides the ability to consume more oxygen prevents exhaustion. The traditional VO2 max test protocol does not resemble how people exercise in the real world. In a race, runners cover a predetermined distance as quickly as possible. This is known as a closed-loop task. By contrast, in a standard VO2 max test, runners choose their own finish line by quitting when they feel they cannot continue any longer. That's an open-loop task. Exercise scientists overlooked this discrepancy for decades before some of them finally began to wonder what difference a closed-loop VO2 max test might make. In 2010, Lex Mauger and Nick Sculthorpe at the University of Bedfordshire, England, created one.
The Mauger-Skull-Thorpe test is fixed at 10 minutes in length. Those 10 minutes are divided into 2-minute stages. Whereas in a conventional VO2 max test, the treadmill speed is increased by a predetermined amount every 2 minutes. In the Mauger-Skull-Thorpe protocol, subjects are instructed to adjust their own speed to attain incrementally increasing ratings of perceived effort. The last 2 minutes are run at the highest level of effort the subject can tolerate, much like the last 2 minutes of a race. Mauger and Skull-Thorpe got an unexpected result when they compared their test against the traditional VO2 max test. On average, the subject's VO2 max scores were 8% higher in the new, closed-loop test than they were in the standard open-loop test. Why? The author speculated that the difference was motivation. Human beings are task-oriented by nature. In the Mauger-Skull-Thorpe test, subjects know where the end is before they start. They have a specific goal, which motivates them to work harder. In the traditional test, subjects are given only the prospect of ever-increasing misery until they raise a white flag of surrender. That's less motivating. Runners are generally quite willing to suffer, but they need a reason. In a race or other closed-loop task, they have something to suffer for. In a traditional VO2 max test, they seemingly suffer just to suffer, and it feels unnatural. If this motivation-based explanation is correct, then performance in a conventional VO2 max test is not limited by physiology, as it was always assumed to be, but rather by psychology. Other evidence suggests that running performance is always limited by psychological factors, even in closed-loop tasks such as races. For example, studies have found that when subjects are injected with a drug that makes exercise feel easier, their performance in a race simulation improves. This wouldn't happen unless athletes normally completed races with reserve physical capacity, despite feeling as though they've given it their all. There is an emerging consensus among exercise scientists that runners and other endurance athletes invariably encounter a limit to how much suffering they are willing to tolerate before they encounter any hard physical limit, such as their true VO2 max. In the past, scientists believed that exhaustion was strictly caused by physiological factors such as acidosis brought on by insufficient oxygen supply to the muscles. But this idea is contradicted by the fact that runners reach exhaustion at varying levels of muscular acidosis, depending on the circumstances. The same is true for muscle glycogen depletion and for every other physical limit believed to cause fatigue. Runners are seldom in precisely the same physiological state at the point of exhaustion in separate tests. The only factor that predicts exhaustion perfectly every time is perceived effort. Athletes always feel they cannot continue when they quit, regardless of their physiological status. This does not mean that tolerance for suffering itself is immovable. As we've already heard in relation to the different VO2 max testing protocols, motivation affects a runner's ability to suffer. Other research has shown that runners perform better in competitive fitness tests than they do in solo fitness tests. When quitting means losing, runners suddenly discover they are able to suffer a little more than they previously felt they could. Tolerance for suffering is also trainable. Once a runner has discovered she can suffer more than she thought she could, her perception of effort changes in a lasting way. This was shown in another study involving a closed-loop VO2 max test. Subjects first completed a conventional open-loop test, and then, on a separate occasion, they underwent a closed-loop test. On average, their VO2 max scores were 4.4% higher in the closed-loop test. Finally, the subjects went back and repeated the conventional VO2 max test. This time, they were able to attain the same level of oxygen consumption as in the closed-loop test. The trainability of suffering tolerance may account for a big chunk of the gains in fatigue resistance and race performance that runners achieve through years of consistent training. Studies suggest this process starts on day one,
before a newbie runner has even had a chance to get fitter. For example, in 2013, a team of New Zealand researchers found that children between the ages of 9 and 11 years improved their 800-meter run time significantly in their first four attempts at this distance, without doing any training between trials, and without adjusting their initial pacing strategy. They improved simply by learning to better interpret their sense of effort and by exploiting what they learned to dig deeper into their physical reserves. The same process continues well beyond the point where an experienced runner stops getting fitter. In 2007, Ethiopia's Haile Gebrselassie, then 34 years old and 16 years into his career as a professional runner, set a marathon world record of 2 hours, 4 minutes, 26 seconds. The first words out of his mouth afterward were, "I can run faster." A year later, Gebrselassie returned to the same event, the Berlin Marathon, and ran exactly 1 second per mile faster. He wasn't fitter than he'd been 12 months before, and he certainly wasn't younger. He just tried harder. Low-intensity, high-volume training develops the sort of suffering tolerance that enhances fatigue resistance more effectively than does speed-based training. Fast runs may hurt more, but long runs hurt longer. The slow burn type of suffering that runners experience in longer, less intense workouts is more specific to racing. Speed-based training teaches the mind to expect a quick end to the discomfort of running in a fatigued state. As hard as Emil Zatopek pushed himself in his epic interval workouts, he was never more than 400 meters away from catching a breather. This must have limited him psychologically in races of 5,000 and 10,000 meters. Indeed, Zatopek had a reputation for erratic pacing, as though he was unable to sustain a consistent level of effort. And it probably held him back even more in the few marathons he ran. In contrast, low-intensity, high-volume training teaches the mind to accept that it might as well make peace with its suffering because it won't end anytime soon. You might not think that the different relationships to suffering that are taught by mostly slow training and speed-based training matter much, but there is proof they do. Some of this proof comes from another experiment conducted by Véronique Bellat. In this study, a group of distance runners and a group of sprinters were required to complete a run to exhaustion at a high but submaximal intensity, halfway between the lactate threshold and VO2 max, or roughly 10K race pace. This was a type of challenge that would have been quite familiar to the distance runners from training and competition, but not to the sprinters, who had been accustomed to shorter, faster efforts. Even though all of the subjects ran at the same relative intensity, the distance runners gave lower ratings of perceived effort throughout the test. They also gave rosier estimates of how long they felt they could continue at various intermediate points of the run. Bellat concluded that the distance runners' high volume, mostly low-intensity style of training had instilled in them a greater tolerance for the type of suffering that is experienced in middle-distance and long-distance races. It appears, then, that the approach to training that is taken in the 80-20 method does a better job than does speed-based training of equipping runners with the psychological wherewithal to dig deeper into their physical reserves. But it does more than that. Mostly slow training also does a better job of strengthening the parts of the brain where tolerance for suffering resides. The brain and fatigue resistance. Runners often observe that very long runs and races are more mentally challenging than shorter ones. There's a reason for this. Studies have shown that prolonged exercise at low intensity fatigues the brain to a much greater degree than does high-intensity exercise that doesn't last as long. In one such study, subjects were required to hold an isometric contraction of the calf muscles as long as possible at three different intensities, 25%, 50%, and 75% of maximum. On average, the subjects were able to sustain the 25% contraction 10 times longer than the 75% contraction. The primary cause of exhaustion at these two intensities was different as well. Scientists are able to assess the contribution of brain fatigue to overall exercise fatigue
by measuring the decline in maximum contraction force of the muscles from pre-workout to post-workout. A bigger decline indicates a more tired brain. In this particular study, the maximum voluntary contraction force of the calf muscles declined by 11% in the low-intensity trial, whereas it did not decline at all in the high-intensity trial. These results show that the brain was fatigued after the low-intensity test and therefore unable to activate the muscles as forcefully. We already know that inducing fatigue in the body through exercise triggers adaptations that make the body more resistant to fatigue in the future. Brain fatigue works the same way. Low-intensity runs lasting long enough to tire out the brain strengthen the parts of the brain that aid fatigue resistance. Shorter, faster runs aren't as effective as fatiguing and strengthening these brain areas, which include the insular and temporal lobes, whose job is to perceive the physical elements of emotional states, such as the discomfort of extreme effort, and the anterior cingulate cortex, ACC, whose job is to resolve internal conflicts, such as the conflict between the desire to keep going and the desire to quit when one is running in a fatigued state. The stronger these areas become, the more slowly a runner's sense of effort will increase in races and workouts, and the longer he or she will be able to endure the agony of severe fatigue. It is important to understand that the duration of exercise matters far more than does the intensity of exercise with respect to the goal of enhancing fatigue resistance in the brain. What counts is not how hard the muscles are working, but rather how long the brain is required to stay focused on the task at hand. In fact, research has shown that the brain can be fatigued at rest in a way that increases fatigue resistance and physical endurance. In 2012, Samuele Marcora, an exercise scientist at the University of Kent, tested the effects of sedentary brain training on physical endurance. He created a video game that was designed to fatigue and thereby strengthen the anterior cingulate cortex, the part of the brain that helps runners resist the temptation to quit. Marcora then recruited a bunch of non-athletes as subjects and had half of them play the brain training game regularly for 6 weeks, while the other half watched documentary films instead. Both groups were instructed not to change their exercise habits during the study period. At the start and end of the study, the two groups completed an endurance test consisting of a stationary bike ride to exhaustion. Incredibly, time to exhaustion increased by an average of 20% in the brain-trained subjects, compared to no improvement in the other group. These results demonstrate that brain fitness makes a major contribution to physical endurance that is completely independent of physiology below the neck. You don't even have to exercise to increase brain fitness and fatigue resistance in endurance exercise. All it requires is sustained mental focus on a cognitively demanding task. Of course, building brain fitness through running itself will improve running performance more effectively than building it outside of running. But since the development of brain fitness requires only prolonged task focus and does not require major strain on the body, long runs at low intensity represent the most effective way to boost the brain's capacity to resist fatigue. This helps explain why runners such as Paula Radcliffe improve so much by running a lot, mostly at low intensity, and why no runner improves as much with speed-based training. Even in combination, however, brain fitness and aerobic capacity do not entirely account for improvements in running performance. As you will soon see, low-intensity, high-volume training also enhances performance in a way that is altogether separate from the two major components of running fitness.